runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 436, Managing Office 365, with guest Jeremy Thake. Recorded Friday, August 21st, 2015. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. I'm back with Jeremy Thake, who's now a technical product manager at Microsoft and the team responsible for the developer story for Office 365 development, and he's been heavily involved in the SharePoint community since 2006. I remember you as an AvePoint guy, actually.
That's right. I was there for 3 years in New York. That was my first relocation kind of stint from Australia over to America, and really enjoyed my time there, but I just got this amazing opportunity to work with, you know, people I've looked up to for a long, long time, being on the outside of Microsoft.
Because you were SharePoint MVP at one point too.
Yeah, that's right. When I was in Australia, I did a lot of community work and a lot of blogging. And it was interesting because I was doing all this blogging in Australia and never really traveled overseas for an event. And I came to the SharePoint conference in 2009. Mm-hmm. And met all these fellow bloggers and people I'd been, you know, IMing with for so long in person. It was a very surreal because I've been doing it for years. And shortly after that, after meeting with a lot of Microsoft people, I was nominated for an MVP. And I think I was an MVP for 5 years prior to handing in that that recognition when I joined Microsoft.
Yeah, if you pick up the blue badge, you got to put down the MVP.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you ever leave, you don't get it back right away. You have to earn it back a year later.
And the earning is a lot harder if you leave and try and want to get it back again, that's for sure.
No kidding. Well, I got to wonder now on the inside, do you actually see that MVP process? Is that part of your role?
Yeah, so I'm a TPM, so technical product manager in marketing, mm-hmm. but our team is very dev focused. We're very close to engineering, whereas, you know, in my building here, building one, there's other people who kind of do go-to-market or things like Sway and OneNode and Skype for Business, and
right.
they're not very technical. All the dev story across all of those products comes through our team.
Oh, interesting.
And part of that is that, you know, we're very tight with the MVPs because they give an extreme amount of valuable feedback back to engineering because they're kind of our foot soldiers out there working with customers. And, you know, they're very good at being quite blunt and opinionated. And and I like that because I'm like that.
Yeah, you get to the point, right? Like,
right.
just got to focus on the issues.
Sometimes if people dance around it and try and be too polite or, you know, here's five positives and here's one negative. Like, I'd rather just tell me everything you hate about it, and then we can balance that with the engineering teams on what we need to do next.
Right. It's not that you don't want to hear about stuff that people like. It's that you can't – there's not much to fix with stuff that people like.
Yeah, that's right. We want to keep our engineers busy.
Yeah.
And so we have to review with the MVP – team that now reports through DX, which used to be called DPE.
Right.
And so we have to kind of give feedback on, you know, what kind of impact they're having on our technology, mm-hmm. both outbound in the community, but also when they're giving feedback to engineering or how much blogging they're doing or whether they're contributing to our open source projects and those types of things. So yeah, being an MVP and now not, you know, I have a good sense of who the top guys are and what I would expect. And I guess the bar was fairly high with me because I did do a lot of blogging as part of my role at AvePoint. Actually, they encouraged me to do a lot of community
sure.
work. But for a lot of MVPs, it's hard because, you know, you got to work to earn the big bucks and, you know, carving out time for the community stuff is, you know, it's hard for people, especially if they've got kids and a wife at home as well to entertain.
There's a real art form in being an effective member of the community and having that beneficial to your career as well, like being able to tie those things together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no way I would have got my job at AvePoint without having that community involvement
sure.
and having that profile that I had. And you know, in the same deal with Microsoft, I probably wouldn't have been considered for the role if it hadn't been the fact that they knew me through the speaking circuit and knew my expertise. So, yeah, there's definitely paid off for me in spades, really.
Yeah, I think that first show we did together was at a tech ed somewhere, maybe New Orleans.
It was. It was a long time ago, too.
And, of course, you always had a SharePoint focus. And Office 365, I swear it has an identity crisis. It's so many different things.
It really is. I've been doing SharePoint since the 2003 days.
The dark times.
The dark times where there was no real customization story. And then when obviously it evolved with kind of the ASP.NET platform and farm solutions, ESPs, then there really was a strong story and customers were willing to kind of go and build on top of that. But Office 365, SharePoint Online is, a piece of that service. Exchange Online is obviously probably one of the major reasons people jump onto the service. That's the first thing that's easy to chew off.
A lot of people buy that. In fact, a little while ago, I did a show about the Exchange Online protection. So even before you move your mailbox, put your spam controls out there.
Yep.
And then you can move. Like, these are all the things that are like, it's the crack dealer effect, right? The first hit is pretty cheap and pretty small, but bit by bit, more and more. So I definitely see people getting into Office 365 for the Exchange part, but it's not the only thing.
No, and I think, from the identity crisis thing, you're right. Like, obviously, we have OneDrive for Business, which is the commercial companion to our personal consumer OneDrive scenario with files sharing and syncing. And then we have SharePoint, which is really our collaboration area. But then there's a bunch of other services in there as well. Like, it always surprises me the amount of organizations that don't use Skype for Business.
Yes.
And it's just so easy to set up now on a PC, just installing that client directly from, logging into portaloffice.com/home and getting all your bits you need for whatever platform. It always surprised me that workload isn't something that's a no-brainer for organizations.
But Link was always a scary product. You can call it Skype.
On-prem, for sure.
For sure. It was one. Yep. But so was SharePoint.
Yep. A lot of people made a lot of dollars being a consultant designing even farm architecture.
Yeah.
Let alone the consultancy dollars around developing on top of it as well.
Yeah. But, when you buy these things via the cloud, life's a heck of a lot less painful.
Yeah. And so, we appreciate. And for me, in my role now, going from being a SharePoint guy to now being an Office 365 dev guy, I've had to learn, Skype for Business APIs and their SDKs, Yammer, Exchange APIs, all the mail calendar contact stuff.
Right.
OneNote as well, which I absolutely love as a consumer of. But their APIs and the add-in support that's coming for that is going to be huge. So, I have to try and be dangerous enough to code and be able to talk to ISVs about, what it can and can't do. If you put me in a dark room with no internet and no code samples, I would probably struggle to build a OneNote app for sure. But, I understand the concepts of all these things and can usually unblock people and point people to the right resources online.
And this is much more that mashup mentality. Rather than write your own document management tool or your own emailing tool, you're being able to tap into these APIs of the tools that your employees are already using. All these users are using Exchange, Outlook and OneNote and so forth. To be able to have a dev team do some customizations, that's real value provided to the organization.
Yeah, and actually, I did a keynote yesterday, and I was joking with the IT pros in the audience, saying, how many times the developer asked you to spin up a SMTP server so that their business application could send email.
Right.
And now, with the mail APIs, it's just a simple REST call to send a mail in context of that user that's logged into their web application.
I'm sorry, did you say a developer asking IT pros for something?
Well, sometimes they ask.
They would just lit their own SMTP service and your gateway would have caught. Who's talking on 25? What's going on?
It is so true. And I put my hands up now and say I've done that more than totally once in different customers.
Yeah, so, the fact that you could have a set of standards around this sort of thing and say, hey, you need to send mail. Here's the API that's approved. This is the one you can use. It's properly logged. It's backed up. It's tracked. Like, all that stuff is done already because it's part of our Exchange install effectively.
Right. And a big part of why SharePoint was so successful was that it enabled people to build this notion of a website without having to go to IT to ask for them to spin up a web server in IIS or, a web application and an existing IIS web server.
Yeah.
Because you could just go and create a new site collection, you'd be away. And I think that, you know, in the grassroots in 2003, that was really where big enterprises saw the benefits of it. It was that it was enabling these information workers and more likely power users,
right,
which, as a subset, to go away and do these things without really having to involve IT. And obviously it was on rails. There was things that, you know, they were allowed to do out of the box and yep. weren't based on permissions. And that was really the success of SharePoint. And then I think the next phase of the success was then, well, these team sites didn't quite do what they wanted them to do, or there was business process through workflow or forms through InfoPath that, you know, really saw the success in the 2007 and 2010 days of SharePoint as well.
Right. Well, you know, I certainly had the experience wearing my IT hat of SharePoint the virus. You know, with people just lighting up SharePoint sites any which way. Like, it made us better IT people because you had to get better governance around this or it got right. wildly out of control.
But it was one of these things, you know, as an architect back in when I was in Australia as a consultant, you know, it was hard to predict and guess the usage that you get out of sure. SharePoint to understand what farm, what it would look like how many web servers I'd need and how many search servers I'd need in that particular farm. So I think the beauty of Office 365 now is that's kind of all done for you, and you don't really have to do any of that thought process now like you did on an on-premise farm.
And the financial model is brilliant too, right? If somebody's yep. really using SharePoint in a big way, you can see what part of their cost that is, and you can allocate that out. Like, it's yep. it's way, and you know, it's another way to treat the virus too. It's like, you can't just light any old thing you want. If you want it, you put it over there and you pay for it.
Right. Yeah, I've been in organizations where they're like, well, we can't afford the licensing of another bunch of servers in this farm, yeah. so we're going to have to not build on SharePoint and build on something else.
Yeah, do it a totally different way.
Right. Or go, we'll use SharePoint Server, SharePoint Foundation, mm-hmm. Which obviously we announced when we started talking about SharePoint Server 2016 that there won't be a Foundation edition or SKU with the 2016 release that, you know, we've got in preview coming up soon.
Yeah, for sure. So when we start getting our teams building this sort of mashup approach to integrating all the different pieces together. And it's not just the Office 365 stack. I think I've been looking at the Azure web app parts to plug into Salesforce. Like, there's really an amazing set of stuff here. How do we end up managing all of this from an IT perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think before, like, the management was kind of scoped, you could kind of put a ring fence around the SharePoint farm and you were pretty good to go.
Right.
So as a developer, when I've got my development environment, I would be asking IT to spin me up a SharePoint farm, and that was really all I needed. Mm-hmm. Whereas with these mashups now, where they kind of loop and ring things around things like Exchange, whether it's online or server or across Skype for Business, you know, developers need to have those environments set up, but also, you know, for pre-prod and production types environments on premises or in online states, you know, you need to have all those components spun up.
Yeah.
And so it goes from, you know, where is my business application running? Is it inside of SharePoint, or is SharePoint a component of a larger solution which you host as a web application inside of Azure? And I think that's where we're seeing things going, is that because of all these services, I guess, whether we're talking about
yeah.
SharePoint or Exchange or Skype or OneNote and a bunch of other bits and pieces there, all of those things in Office 365 leverage one authentication mechanism, which is Azure Active Directory. So when you log into Office 365, you're using what's called an organizational account, which under the hood is all being kind of processed via Azure Active Directory in the cloud. The nice thing is now with SharePoint Server 2016 and Exchange Server 2016, it's very, very simple to actually go through a wizard to set those environments up on premises with that hybrid support for Azure AD as well.
Right.
So the cool part there is my mashup that's running in a website could be calling SharePoint Server in our custom data center, but it could also be using some stuff in SharePoint Online in Office 365 in our data centers as well. So the mashup can kind of cross those boundaries in ways that would have been a lot of coding before in the past from an auth perspective. Now, what that means for an IT pro, though, is that they need to understand how to set up and configure those environments and maintain Azure Active Directory, which they probably have Active Directory on-prem as well. And, you know, I know you've had shows on before in the sure. past with kind of DirSync and the different approaches of keeping those things in sync up there. into the cloud with Azure AD. But then the other component, which I believe is fairly new to your listeners, is this notion that all of those services use Azure Active Directory, but you can actually create what we call this Azure Active Directory application. And this application is stored within Azure. When you go into the management portal, manage.windowsazure.com, you select the Azure Active Directory instance, and there's an applications tab right next to the users and the groups tabs at the top. And when you click on that, you can create this application, and you can define what permissions that application requires. So I could say that I want read and write access to your SharePoint site collections in online based on the context of whoever's logged into that web application or the mobile application has access to from that perspective. But it could also say I would like to send mail using Exchange Online on behalf of that user.
Right.
And again, like for OneNode and Skype, all those permissions are in there all loaded up for you to request those permissions. Now, the nice thing about this is gone are the days then of an IT pro kind of seeing all these service accounts accessing various servers where they're calling through and not really knowing what permissions that service account has to that granular permission level in an easily disclosed way. Whereas now with this management portal kind of view, I can see exactly what applications inside my Azure Active Directory, how many there are, who has access to use these applications, because with the Azure Active Directory premium SKU, you can actually do things like say, I only want the finance Active Directory group to have access to this web application.
Nice.
Which is something you really couldn't do easily unless you built that into each individual web application that your developers
built. Your developers have to write that if in role code all over the app.
And so now it kind of puts those types of controls back into the IT pro's hands and not into the developer's hands. And I know it's kind of that trust issue that always exists between IT pros and devs, but I think the beauty there is there's one implementation of it.
Yeah, you've got it living in a place pretty much external to the app in some respects.
Correct, yeah. And it's something that, you know, you can do dynamically with Azure Active Directory Premium as well, with the dynamic groups scenario as well. So it could be like based on their job title, this dynamic group can be allocated to an Azure Active Directory application as well. So there's a few different ways that you can kind of almost do granting permissions of these applications, and also manage what those applications have access to within your environment, all from one interface.
That's awesome. Jeremy, give me one second to pay the bills, because Run As Radio is brought to you by ScriptRock, the makers of Guardrail and the fighters of Configuration Drift. Configuration Drift happens in every environment from 5 nodes to 5,000. Guardrail will find and scan the configs of every node in your environment, no matter the platform, and alert you to changes happening across machines. Give it a try for 3 months free with the coupon code RUNASRADIO, all one word, at scriptrock.com/RUNASRADIO. So let me take the security model up another notch. Can I hook audit to all of this as well?
Yeah, and that's where I was going. So there are some really amazing reports that the Azure Active Directory team do to show you kind of the usage of those applications. So you can see which users have used them.
Right.
You can actually, you know, as I was saying about granting and denying people, but you can also see who's kind of tried to get to them directly as well if you don't go to that level of governing who can and can't see them. So, for instance, I could see that, and we'll get on this in a moment, but for instance, do.com is a software as a service that supports signing in via Office 365, and that user could consent that he wants do.com to have access to their individual calendar. So the administrators of Azure Active Directory could go in and see that, oh, do.com is someone in my environment is using that.
Right.
And they've consented this. So it can be done at a user consent level, but it can also be done an admin consent level. And there are governance controls there that you can turn on and off to say, I wish that every single new application that we're not aware of that hasn't ever been consented either by an admin or a user is denied if a user tries to get in.
Nice.
And then what that would mean then is that the user would have to reach out to the IT department to get them to consent on their behalf so they could have access to it.
This is the claims-based security model we always wanted.
It really is. And it, I guess the only thing that we, you know, we're seeing as a pain, and I see personally as a pain, is that, you know, MSIT, which is our internal IT, yeah, is a big org, and knowing who to go and ask to get permissions to, for them to consent my access, is tough. And there's some, stuff coming in the future to make that easier, kind of workflow between the user and the people kind of controlling the keys if they have locked it down.
Yeah, that the you really want a great tool that can visualize for this app. Here's the set of claims. Here are the rules around the particular claim. You know, all right, you have a right to a mailbox, but only the one that you're logged into by your account. Then a list of all those accounts. It's sort of see, I really want to be able to see who's using it, what features are they using, what features have they requested, don't have access to. Like, just, you could really color code that whole thing and really have a big view of what's going on. But that's not a small piece of software to write either.
No, and I think, you know, there's some organizations out there, and this is something that kind of, although it's, you know, I'm talking from an Office 365 perspective, this flexibility can be done for all Azure Active Directory supported sure. web applications. And, you know, if you go to azure.com and look at the Azure Marketplace, there's thousands of web applications out there that support Azure Active Directory now that, regardless of whether you're in Office 365, this is a reality. It's just that the Office 365 services are the first ones in there that you can request permissions for. There's a lot of the guys in the marketplace that just leverage it from an auth perspective as a sign-in. But I think you'll see more and more now that these web applications will want more than just, I know it's Jeremy Thake. It'll be, I know it's Jeremy Thake, and he's also consented me access to his calendar.
Right.
So that maybe I can handle some scheduling for him based on his availability that he has in his corporate calendar.
Yeah, which is that we can get in because we have this granularity. We can start getting into the more and more of the detailed shared permissions or even some external permissions too, just to be able to have the vendor have access right. to some things. But that's always been, it's one thing to manage the employees, the internal users, but some of that external communication, that's much trickier to get at. And this seems like it'd be symmetrical across that.
Yeah. And so there's controls within manage.windowsazure.com, which is in the web user interface, but also via the Azure CLI, which you can download as part of the SDK or just individually. You can actually go in and do even more things, like you can blacklist applications or whitelist them. Mm-hmm. So I could say, under no circumstances, if someone goes to badthings.jeremythake.com, can anyone ever user consent that application?
Right.
So it doesn't have to be an all over block of no applications can ever be user consented. You could actually just black and whitelist applications via the Azure CLI. And there's great documentation on the Azure website around that approach.
Yeah. And this gets into a philosophical debate as well, because I mean, blacklisting used to be the only way. But I know lots of organizations now that love their whitelists. Like, these are the apps, there is nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, now you must negotiate to be added to the whitelist.
Right, and you've got to do this funky dance with the people who own the keys to the kingdom to get on that right. whitelist.
And it means you can't, it slows down responsiveness, right?
Right, right.
This is where security gets a reputation as a business impediment rather than a facilitator.
And unfortunately, you know, from a productivity perspective, a lot of these web applications that are already in that marketplace are really useful to end users.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned do.com. It's a great way of managing meetings, and it pulls through your appointments in your calendar without you having to kind of enter them yourself in a very easy, you know, synced way, and integrates with Skype for Business and things like that. So if they can't consent that, then they just can't use that app at all. So it's a bit of a shame that when departments do that. So, you know, you don't want to be that hindrance on productivity within your org.
Yeah, you want to be able to give a sense of granularity to, you know, these apps, you know, may not have been specifically whitelisted, but they're not on the blacklist either. So that's right. Okay. You know, give them a try. I'd like it from an InfoSec perspective, you know, from a security ops perspective, to be notified when a new app comes into my ecosystem.
Yep. Yep. And you know, there's a little bit of entrusting your employees to when they click consent, they realize what they're consenting to. Like, it doesn't just jump in without telling them it needs access to your files in OneDrive or access to your calendar, or it can send email. It'll explicitly tell you what it will do on that screen, which is really neat.
Well, I'm hoping, you know, people have gotten more educated this just by owning smartphones in general.
Although, or like being on Facebook and getting accidentally installing the Farmville app and then realizing it's pinging all your friends to invite them to Farmville. And
yep.
having that embarrassing moment, though. Well, I guess I did click that OK button when I installed Farmville in the first place.
Yes. I know some of these forms are brutal to read, and you just keep hitting OK to make them go away. But, you know, read a little.
Yeah, yeah.
Try and write better ones.
And I guess the heads up here is that from an exposure perspective, we're supporting this motion of, I guess, being an open type approach to this and the trusting of the employee or the user of Office 365 by having this app launcher in the top left corner of our user interface in the web browser. So we have the app launcher in the top left, which you click on, and it will basically show you a pop over or hover over panel that lists a bunch of our applications, whether it be Word or PowerPoint or Excel or Mail or People, which is our contacts and the calendar. And that app launcher is available across all of our user experience in the browser. So if I'm in Mail, I can still get to it. If I'm in a SharePoint site, I can get to it. If I'm over in Yammer, I can get to it. But as well as having all of our applications, what we call the first party apps, we also have a tile there for the store. And clicking on that store will list all of those applications that users can go and add and consent to and get them in and leverage them with their authorization to the services that the application requires. So Do.com being one, Smartsheet, which is a local Seattle company, which does something very clever. It's kind of like Excel on steroids with a certain take. It's very, very neat way of handling things. And there's a bunch of others in there. In the education space, where we're seeing a huge draw in the schooling system with EDU, with some really cool like storyboard type comic building applications on the web that students use to kind of do presentations in class back to their teachers around what they've learned around history, for instance. So all those web applications can be added and consented to by, again, the admins or the users.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great discovery place for them inside the Office store there. Store.office.com.
So, this basically could be your company store for apps.
Yes. Yeah.
You can put whatever you want. So my own internal apps as well, I can put them up there?
Yeah. So not in the store, but what happens is when you click on the app launcher, as well as listing our apps and the store tile, there's a My Apps button that you can click. And when you click on that, the top grouping of tiles are the ones that we present to you.
Right.
And then the second set of groupings are any applications that have been acquired by the store or are applications that you have built in-house that have been also registered via Azure AD as an application, and they'll show up there too. So if I had an expense tracking web application, for instance, I could register that as a web application inside of Azure Active Directory.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as I go, well, I want this expense tracking application available to my sales team via maybe an Active Directory group.
Yep.
That will then appear on anyone who is a sale in that group when they log in to that My Apps page. And the nice thing there is that they can right click on that, or sorry, they click the parentheses on the tile for that expense tracking tile, and they can pin that, which will then show it in that app launcher that's then is on every single hover over when you click on that little icon at the top left. So it's, again, very good visibility as for all of your enterprise web applications. You know,
can you push it down? Can you actually install this the next time the guy logs in?
You can push it to the My Apps page.
Okay.
Right now, you can't push it pinned.
Okay.
So it would be up to the user to pin it, but he will be able to see it.
But, you know, if they want to get their expenses, they're going to click on it.
They're absolutely going to want to get paid back for their expenses.
Yeah, right.
It's something I actively have on my calendar every month here at Microsoft.
Welcome to the big corp, dude.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is there that, you know, MSIT is doing this a lot already internally. And I remember being at a mining company in Australia where we had systems all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Some were Java, some were ASP, some were PHP, just depending on what dev team
who built it.
But the nice thing is now is that though any of those applications can incorporate Azure Active Directory authentication very easily via an ADOR library.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be registered as an application in Azure Active Directory and appear in that My Apps list. So gone are the days where developers have to worry about single sign-on. Again, the IT guys can see all of the applications that exist all over the place in one single location and see the usage of them. But also as an end user, I don't have to remember all those darn URLs.
Yeah.
That were, I'm sure, you know, lots of thought were put into the expense manager being MS expense 1 and MX expense 2 as a URL. Now I just go to my apps page and I click on the tile, or I pin the tile to the app launcher if I'm using it all the time. So it solved a grand old problem of, you know, like trying to work out where all these corporate apps are.
Sure. I mean, this is what we used to build portals for, right?
Absolutely.
Try and give a home to all these different origin things. So, you know, why build one when there's one there that is also a working piece of the puzzle? Because it'll actually have, you know, it's easy to build a portal until you actually want to have security around it, where it's like, oh, I'm not going to show you apps you can't install. Like, it's suddenly way more complex.
Yeah, and so the ADOR guys, the authentication libraries, the SDKs, you know, the team here have done a great job of making sure that, you know, all these languages and platforms are covered, so that, you know, IT can almost insist that, you know, you got to turn off basic auth or claims or however else you've used it, and just implement these libraries.
Right.
And off you go. And the benefit to the IT Pro is, you know, there's one standard then, but also they get that visibility, they get that tracking that they would have never have had before. With the other approaches of configuring the auth directly in IIS or on an Apache server.
Yeah, it's way, way simpler to go about this. It does sound like it's a bit of a commitment, though. Obviously, you got to be in Office 365, which is a step. But once you've got that Active Directory bridge in place and starting to utilize this stuff, which you've got to do if you're going to use Exchange or OneDrive for Business, I mean, any of them, really.
Right.
Any of those initial lead-ins open the door to all of this.
Yeah, and I think the point there around you need Office 365, I guess, even if you didn't have Office 365 and you just wanted that tracking of web applications that
right.
are using the auth, all you really need actually is Azure Active Directory. I mean, you might want to bump it up to Azure Active Directory Premium to get a little more features and reporting and,
sure.
and management. But, you know, obviously, if you're using Office 365, you get the ability to go a lot further on what services you can actually loop into too.
Yeah, good point.
And then once Exchange Server 2016 and SharePoint Server 2016 are hybrid connected, you know, even if you just had Azure Active Directory and those two connected to it, your applications could hook into those things too.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, there's different levels of commitment, or, you know, you could do baby steps first just to get all your applications in a unified way on Azure Active Directory in the first instance, and kind of grow from there.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways in the door on this thing, but pretty much once you've taken a step, you're going to have access to all of this. And I think it's pretty powerful to be able to consider the idea of having a unified place for all of those applications. And they don't have to use the Microsoft stack. You just have to tie in the authentication piece.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, from a Microsoft perspective, we're working very hard to make sure that, you know, wherever you go on any kind of software as a service application in an online presence, we want to make sure there's a sign-in as Azure AD or sign-in as organizational account sitting there.
Yep.
So that, you know, when you own XYZ finance CRM system that's out there, you know it'll just easily allow you to sign in with that organizational account and be away.
Yep. Suddenly, single sign-on is no longer a dream. It's the thing that makes everything else work.
Right. And that's the other beauty of it. Like, if I click on that tile in my app launcher or my apps page,
yep.
If you look at what it's doing in the browser in the address bar, it jumps to Azure AD URL first, and then it posts the token to that web application. And then the web application has that token that it can then use to re-access services that Azure AD has stored permissions for, services like SharePoint and Exchange and Skype, etc.
Awesome. Hey, Jeremy, I feel like we're just getting into this now because there's so much more to talk about once you start drilling into the way different applications can be assembled and operated from it.
Yeah, it's definitely a deep, deep, deep hole of story once you start drilling into what services are available. But I think, you know, the power of from a management portal for an IT pro to be able to just kind of have that visibility at that high level and start thinking about that integrations. It's really exciting, I think, for organizations that want to really streamline how they're doing authentication and permissions and reporting. I'm sure it will start to highlight those applications they're spending thousands of dollars maintaining,
sure.
running on a web server that no one's actually using.
True enough.
It would scare certain business owners, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Thanks so much for spending some time chatting with us about this.
No, you're welcome. It's good to be back on the show.
You're good. I'm glad to have you back, and welcome to the other side.
I know. And since being on the show last time, when I first joined the team, actually, I started my own podcast. So I figured I might just pitch that here. It's very more for a developer audience. So obviously listeners who are more IT pro based, go tell all your devs in your office. But we do a weekly show where we talk about everything developer orientated with the Office ecosystem. And obviously I've learned a lot from Ewan and then Carl from both this podcast and .NET Rock.
So sure.
I really appreciate how you've set the bar very, very high.
We've had a lot of practice.
Yeah.
So is that the Office 365 Developer Podcast?
Yeah. So our website is dev.office.com, and there's a resources tab there, and podcast is one of the menu options, along with training, where there's like 80 hours of training. And, you know, for IT pros, we've got some really nice hands-on labs that are very easy to get into with very little developer experience if you just want to play. Because I know, and I've worked with enough IT pros to know they do like to tinker. As much as they don't claim to be devs. So there's plenty of training there. If they just want to kind of get the idea of it in a test tenant, they can start to create these things and understand it.
For sure. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No, you're welcome, mate. Have a good weekend.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.